thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. This is my first time giving a seminar here. So I'm taking a chance of discussing more pheno stuff, but I've prepared like backup stuff for the more theoretical aspects of this. So it depends on how the flow goes. We can go back and forth. So I'm going to be discussing mainly the body of work that we've done in the last, let's say, 2 years. And it all revolves around this kind of experiments where we have a bunch of protons and neutrons and a bunch of protons and neutrons from heavy ions colliding and passing through each other. And the question is, what happens when they pass through each other? What do we create there? And how do we, let's say, how can we isolate the areas in which we can continue to work with regular QCD or electromagnetic probes and stuff like that, and where we cannot, and we need to do some work about that. This was my alternative name for my talk. My son, Halloween is the his best day of the year, and that's Stranger Things is the most the best TV show he watches, and so I made this for him because I'm dealing with strangers in this talk, so I'm thinking of him. So let me put some language so we can communicate throughout this talk. Usually in heavy ion collisions, we are having a picture of an initial situation in which these ions not necessarily come in face to face. And so we need to quantify this initial condition. If there is more or less overlap between the heavy ions, we quantify it in terms of theoretically in terms of an impact parameter, but experimentally in terms of centrality. And I'm going to be referring to this thing here in the initial condition. Depending on many things, energy of the collision, the geometry of the collision, and many other things, I will have the conditions or I will not have the conditions to have enough energy per unit volume to create a QGP phase, a plasma phase, where the protons and neutrons are no longer there as a confined bunch of things, but I have a free charge in a kind of like a fluid phase. And then I will be able to think about what happens to this state when it cools down and it expands. And I have to think about how to connect the early phases of this collision with what I'm recovering in the detector. So when I say signals in this talk, I mean, what can I learn from what I recover from the detector from the different, let's say, epochs in the evolution of the collision? If I want to learn about the deepest or the earliest time after the collision, then I have to figure out which kind of data I take and how I process it. And if I want to decode things about the later stages, then I have to make another choice sometimes. So that's kind of like the cartoon of the relativistic heavy ion collision. Now, I have prepared a list of questions that may be of interest to you guys. I started by telling you, I can start by telling you about an open question regarding how hyperons are coming out of this heavy ion collisions with such a peculiar polarization, let's say. I've also prepared something about things that we can do very well in physics, which is study photons. I mean, we are experts in this, except in heavy ion collisions, we have more photons that we can explain, let's say, theoretically. And so that's like an open question. And if there's time, depending on the interest, I can jump straight into something that is at the back of all these discussions, which is if we are dealing with a situation in which we have quarks and gluons in a fluid phase becoming kind of like a gas of hadrons, there should be a phase transition. I should be able to see signals of criticality in the particles that I recover, and I should be able to probe whether or not there is some kind of critical point in this phase diagram of nuclear matter. So those are the things that I can tell you about. Let me start with the first one and then see how it goes in terms of time. How much time I have? Probably
an hour.
An hour, okay. So very quickly, around 2017, STAR collaboration presented this very nice result in which they show experimentally that if they collide heavy ions and they analyze lambda hyperons, they can estimate through the polarization of this hyperon that the matter at the center of this collision has some weirdness, has some vorticity, and you can quantify it through this polarization. This was an amazing result, and the size of this vorticity, you can even estimate the size just by assuming that that the protons are moving here at some fraction of the speed of light, and assuming that the radius of a gold nucleus or a lead nucleus is around 7 Fermi and such. So you get a humongous vorticity for that matter there after the collision. But what was the issue? Well, for those of you who might know or might not know, these lambda hyperons are very nice to work with because they have very key properties. They are the lightest hyperons you can create with strangers in them, and correspondingly they have a lifetime which allows you to track in a smallish volume in a detector everything about them, where they decayed with precision. The other nice thing about these lambda hyperons is that given that they have a parity violating weak decay, then there is an alignment between the spin of this hyperon and the daughter proton, the product of the decay. So you can sort of connect a very fundamental property of the lambda hyperon with something that has to do with the dynamical properties of the matter where this lambda was, let's say, born.
Do they see the hyperon displaced from the collision point, or?
Well, that's a good thing. So you do see, and part of my first part of the talk is actually realizing where do these lambdas come from? Because as you might imagine by your question, it matters where they are created. If they are very in the edges or in the center, then somehow the way they are polarized will be less or more sensitive to the dynamics of this overlapping weirdly matter, right?
Like the decay, you see the displaced decay of the lambda, or do you see the products coming out of the QGP?
No. It's at the level of the detector is the displaced vertex, yes. Yes, not directly from the QGP. Actually, you just see the daughters, right? The products of the decay, and you measure the distance in the fiducial volume. Yes, and that's how you do reconstruction of this particle, and many others, as a matter of fact. So let me tell you what were the experimental things that they reported there, because this is where things get interesting. They reported the global polarization of this lambda particle. In this plot, lambdas are blue, and anti-lambdas are red. And the horizontal axis is the energy of the collision. So at high energies, let's say LHC energies and up to down to Rieke energies, you have data that is consistent with no polarization. But as you go down to 10 GeV in collision energy, what they reported is that lambdas and anti-lambdas are very polarized, but differently, right? In collision energy. That means I'm going slower, so there's the properties of the so-called QGP that you can form in this region and in that region will be slightly different as well. Not only that, but they show this key result here. And this is what I was telling you about centrality. If I, in zero centrality or in high, almost 100 centrality, I mean collisions that happen when the ions were like head to head And these are peripheral collisions where the ions were like far away. So what they show is that lambdas and anti-lambdas are, let's say, almost, they have almost no polarization and not even distinguishable between them when the collision is very central, very frontal, completely overlapped, one ion with the other. But as you go to off-centered or more peripheral collisions, there's a distinction. Not only you have polarization, but there's also a distinction. So there's like something here telling us that the nature under which these quarks that create that are giving us these lambdas, wherever they were born, somehow we're looking at different aspects or mechanisms under which they are polarized. And well, this was back then. Immediately people say, well, if there is no polarization when the collision is frontal, but a lot of polarization when the collision is peripheral, that means that vorticity or this angular momentum of the system is orienting the spins of these things so that they come out more polarized when there's actually a bigger vorticity, whirliness or vertical flow. And immediately in the years after this result was out, people started to create models in which you can actually calculate using hydrodynamic tools this vorticity, and you can simulate and build the behavior you would have of this. In this case, this is a kinematic vorticity, which is the relativistic version of your regular classical vorticity, the rotational of the velocity. And this is the thermal vorticity, which is slightly different from this one. This involves local velocities in the system, and this involves the local velocity of the system over the temperature. So this kind of vorticity knows something about the medium. And so what they showed throughout the years is that vorticity actually does what you would expect. If you have a very peripheral collision, you have not that much vorticity, but then it starts to increase, and then it dies off when you have basically central collisions. And also, this happens in energy, because you need this velocity, you need this gradient of velocity to be high in order to create this vertical region. So, okay. What is the issue of this? Well, there are several issues with the approach. It's not very clear when you go to low collision energies what you're creating and what are the properties of this stuff that you're creating. And it's not very clear you can install vorticity in this kind of system. It's a small system. It has different properties than the systems you can create at RIC and LHC. And the vorticity as an argument gives you the possibility to turn on and off the polarization according to how this velocity field is, how vertical it is. And if you don't have any vorticity, apparently you shouldn't have any polarization of these lambdas. That's one issue. The other issue is, well, shouldn't they come out equally polarized? Because this is a dynamical thing, and particles and antiparticles that have the same spin should couple to the global angular momentum of the system regardless of, you know, anything. So people are still working on this, and they are including more and more like kind of differential ideas into them in order to describe this apparent situation, different polarization for lambdas and anti-lambdas. What we did was the following. We said, okay, what is the role of the place in which you create your lambdas? What is the role of having lambdas coming from a region in the collision where you have kind of like a dilute system versus a lambda or an anti-lambda that is created in a region where you have the conditions to have the QGP, actually. And how do these lambdas contribute to the global polarization of the system? So we created a, I'm going to show you just briefly the results we have for this kind of model. So this is what we did back into 2020 with this kind of two-component model. Again, we have data from STAR, and the bands are from our model. Now we have a lambda and anti-lambda polarization that polarizes, first of all, differently because they come from these different zones. And the width of this, of what we have from our model is controlled by the time the system has to expand and the time the spin has to couple to the global angular momentum.
Yes. Yes. Can you explain a bit more the shape? Why is there a peak appearing?
Yes. So the purpose of the rest of my talk is to tell you that if let me briefly say tell you the answer is to tell you that if you start to take into account these places where the lambdas are created, as I was explaining with the previous drawing, then what happens is that you have competing processes. You have in the corona, you have basically cold nuclear matter, protons, dilute system, and experimentally we've been doing a lambda hyperon production from proton collisions since the 70s. So we have data from those times. And in the core, what you have is a region in which you can no longer say you have cold nuclear matter, you have sort of a QGP possibility, and for that you have to include the properties of this system. So what happens? There's a competition of production mechanisms. You either have a collision in which the dominant structure is the core, or a collision in which the dominant structure is the corona, so you run out of core, basically. And so it is not uniform growth in polarization. You run out of polarization depending on this fuel that you have from either these two regions. I hope I summarized this idea. I can tell you how it works.
Yeah. I guess you'll explain more later.
So more on that is that back in 2020, we only have data showing a rise, but immediately when we include these differential production mechanisms, what we saw in our model was that there was a maximum and a differentiated peak. These are from our models, but there wasn't any data lower than 7 GeV. Now the picture is different. This is the state-of-the-art data for lambda and anti-lambda polarization up to this year. And now you see other kinds of things. So what you see is that you have Hades giving us data really close to threshold, down to 3 GeVs, down to 2.4 GeVs. And it gives you data that is lower than this peak that we had back in 2020. And so what the data is telling us now is that indeed we have a rise and a lowering thing happening. But the question is still, why is this getting so baroque in a sense? It used to be that we only needed to explain a differentiated polarization. Now we need to explain this kind of rise and lowering of the polarization. And most of the models that people are using today to explain this kind of behavior include somewhere the possibility to have vorticity and to couple the spin of the strange quark for this hyperon to the global angular momentum of the system. We claim.
When you mean vorticity, I'm asking a stupid question.
No, that's fine.
By the way, my Zoom was acting up in the beginning of your talk, so I missed the first. I saw your first slide, and then I missed four slides. Anyway, the question: this vorticity that you're talking about is inside the or gluon plasma, how are we supposed to understand in terms of perhaps superfluids, for example, which I guess this is where I have my intuition about what the vortex in terms that carries angular momentum is. So what is this vorticity quantity here? Is it just the gradient? This is omega mu that you calculate some,
yes,
field?
This is
physically, I mean.
Yes. So non-relativistically is just one half of the curl of the velocity field. Just, yes, like the curl.
So there's just turbulence inside the G, I mean.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as defining a turbulent situation because we are not really there. We are assuming something really simple, which is kind of this picture. Let me show you again. We are assuming that you have a very fast ion crossing another one. So you have charges going very fast in opposite directions, and you have matter, or let's say a spectator, protons and neutrons, that are in the overlapping region, and you can create QGP in this region. And what happens is that, given that this QGP behaves like a fluid, you can have a velocity field that contains vorticity. You may or may not have event by event.
I see. Thank you. Sorry.
So it's like very mechanical, no? But the thing is, for a relativistic situation, we need to consider that if you have the QGP, then this phase of nuclear matter is characterized by its temperature, its chemical potential, and stuff like that. So somehow the vorticity needs to know about all these things, right? So
yeah.
These models that you're showing here, they already show a rise and a fall.
Yes. So in the earlier work, when you just build, imagine you have a vector field of velocities that somebody gives you as an initial condition of these collisions, you can calculate this object. And you can plot it for different centrality situations or impact parameters and for different energies. And yeah, it shows a rise and a lower. The problem is that the rise and the death of vorticity is not explaining exactly this rise and death of polarization, because as I was saying, vorticity doesn't distinguish, or the amount of polarization that you should the lambda and the anti-lambda should have should be the same in from the perspective of vorticity, because this is a coupling between the global angular momentum and the spin of the particle. Naively, you should expect this. And the question is, how much of vorticity is playing this role in this game?
May I ask another even?
Yes. That's okay.
So I would imagine that when you have collisions, and you cannot see, but one time the vorticity in one event is pointing one way, and in another event is pointing the opposite way. So why does it give always an excess of there is, why isn't the probability? Yeah.
Actually, it's even worse than this, I guess. What you actually have is, as an initial condition when you do hydro simulations, is you have a system which has a vector field in 3D, let's say in the region of overlap, right? Yeah. And so you can have a negligible vorticity in one plane, negligible vorticity in another plane, and maybe a little bit of vorticity in the third plane, let's say. So usually this analysis is shown for omega xy, omega yz, etc., and you do averages over many events, and those vorticities that survive this analysis are the ones that you claim are net vorticities that will push for this global polarization.
So why is there a net vorticity if on average it should be zero, right?
If you do the analysis for differentiating the initial condition, no. If you average over the whole minimum bias thing,
Okay, so you're picking out the events.
Yes, let me tell you why, Mina, because this is very important, that the things that you're asking me are relevant to the rest of the talk. The reason I'm making a difference is because I'm biased towards finding out something about the QGP phase. I want to know if polarization is actually telling me about some fundamental processes I'm missing in order to describe how things are polarized in the end. And so I cannot guarantee, due to the energy density and some other quantities, that I can have the possibility to have this phase for any centrality. The optimization of centrality is semi-central collisions in this case.
I see.
That let you see this polarization.
Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. And this is shown in this plot, actually. Let me go back, because I think you missed it probably. If I look at very central collisions, actually, I don't need to worry there, because there's no polarization in this bin of very, very face-to-face collisions. It's only when I go to semi-central where I have this, issue arising.
Since you're showing that again, how do you read the errors there? What's the significance of the...
Actually, yes, good question. The significance here, back then, it was very poor, because you see everything is overlapping. This was just to initiate the discussion, but the state of the art is that these bars are not overlapping anymore.
Those are like one signal?
Yes. And actually, I don't know if in the other one I have the centrality case. Let me see. No, I only have the energy. I can show you the current one. But it's not overlapping anymore in the semi-central region. Thank you for asking me this.
Okay, I have another silly question.
That's okay.
SNN stands for what? Center of energy collision per nucleon?
Yes.
Or per nucleon?
Uh-huh. Binary pair or, yeah. Thank you. Anyways, so since given that vorticity only doesn't help me to describe fully the whole polarization thing, we appeal to the idea of that I was telling you about. We say, how about we differentiate the mechanisms that are transferring this polarization or giving me the availability to create lambdas and anti-lambdas, whether they are coming from the corona or from the core. As I was saying, in the corona, I'm thinking cold nuclear matter, PP collisions, basically. Everything is dilute. And I already know from many, many years ago that I have many options, let me call them options, for the system to transfer polarization to the lambda hyperons. I can have, for example, I can have a polarized gluon that splits into an SS bar pair. I can have a precession. I can have a dipoles separating and creating a SS bar pair that has some amount of, anyways. There's a lot of work that I have no time to go through, but there's, let me say, a reasonable amount of work that helps us understand what happens for lambdas and anti-lambdas created in this corona region. Let's take that into account. And then, if the lambdas and anti-lambdas are created in the core, I'm talking about the core of the overlap region, where they might be a QGP, then you take into account that you have a mechanism, actually, I should call it one of the signatures of the presence of the QGP in these collisions is the fact that you have strangeness and enhancement. The fact that if in the initial conditions you don't have strange at all, somehow for the QGP, you have enhancement due to the fact that these processes are no longer, let's say, suppressed due to this matter-antimatter asymmetry that you have in these initial heavy ion collisions. And there is enough time for these processes, basic QCD processes, to stabilize or thermalize in the lifetime of the QGP. This is work that was done many, many years ago. And so there's a reasonable amount of stuff that we know from a long time ago to understand the availability of strangeness in either the corona or the core. Given this sort of basic background, the rest of the of the proposal is fairly simple. Imagine that you give me the number of lambdas that you have at the end in your detector, and you give me the percentage of those lambdas that come from the core and that come from the corona. Ideally, this is what I would want to know. And if I know that, and if I have the traditional reference vector to define polarization, then I can, with the number of lambdas and the lambda of anti-lambdas, if I have their spin, then I can build the asymmetry to quantify how much of the how many of them are polarized in one way or another. And so, in principle, if you just plug in this idea into the way you evaluate the imbalance of one spin over another or polarization of the system, then you can build the quantification of the polarization of lambdas and anti-lambdas in such a way that you can isolate the contribution to the global polarization of the lambdas that were created in lambdas and anti-lambdas that are created in the corona, separated from the rest of the stuff that is connected to properties of the QGP. This is just an algebraic step. It's fairly simple. The next part is kind of where the modeling starts. This is where we start. So how do we model the amount of polarization that lambdas and anti-lambdas are contributing to the when they are created in the corona? The initial idea was to say, well, in PP collisions, basically everything is consistent with zero. I can tell you more about that if you want at the end. And so a good starting point is to assume that even though lambdas and anti-lambdas are perfectly well created in this corona, their polarization contributes net zero to the global polarization. This was the first step, let's say. Now, the next step is to say something about the polarization of those lambdas and anti-lambdas that are created in the QGP or in the core. Now, for those, I need some kind of idea or parameter that tells me something about the intrinsic polarization of lambdas, how an strange quark that is in the QGP or an anti-strange quark that is in the QGP, how much it can see or be sensitive to the global angular momentum of the system. And for that, I model the polarization in this case, or the number of lambdas with the spin in one direction and in the other, in terms of a intrinsic polarization, which is this Z or Z bar, depending on if it's the particle or the antiparticle. And I will model it as a portion in terms of their abundancy. Okay, I can tell you more about that in a moment. But this is the step where we're transferring we are saying that some amount of the global polarization must come independently of the space-time where these lambdas and anti-lambdas are created if they come from the QGP. And this has to do with the fact that this is a fluid phase and it's expanding anyways. So I have that, and I have to figure out where to get it. Finally, how likely it is to create anti-lambdas in either the core or the corona. This is an issue that is connected with strangeness at availability. And we know that if they are in the QGP, it's as easy to create a lambda than an anti-lambda just because of the availability of matter and antimatter. But the way to include that in our model is to remember that in the QGP, I need to be able to characterize this QGP in terms of chemical, baryon chemical potential and a temperature. If I can do that, then I can know this omega prime, and I can use PP data to extract the ratios of anti-lambdas to lambdas created in the corona. I don't know if anyone wants to ask, I can declare something specifically. But these are the three ingredients in the model. We have, for now, neglected the contribution of lambdas and anti-lambdas to the global polarization if they are created in the corona. We will model from, let's say, first principles, the intrinsic polarization, we have to say how the spin of a strange quark couples to the vorticity of the system. We have to do that with QFT, with fundamental physics. And we have data that tells us about the ratios of lambda and anti-lambda in this case. So we can fit that omega on omega prime. And if we can do that, pending the modeling bit, if you can use all that data, then we can provide a band for this polarization, which is this, where these bands come from. I'm running out of time. Anyways, so PP data, there's a bunch. It's harder to fit lower to threshold production, of course, because you're near, let's say, 4 GeV. And it's better to fit up here. We have more data and better data for higher energy collisions. So we can do that. There's a whole idea and problems to do that from there. So we can get omega from PP data. Omega prime, which is the one that controls the ratio of anti-lambdas to lambdas created in the QGP, you have to tell me basically if you have a thermal system that is characterized by that is created in a way that you have strange quarks and some anti-symmetry between them and anti-strange, and you have a temperatures of the system, then you have to tell me how this omega behaves in terms of those ideas. And it turns out that there's a bunch of work of many people that have made a connection in the phase diagram of nuclear matter between the temperature and the baryon chemical potential. And you have a mapping between the energy of the collision and the chemical potential and the temperature of the system. So you can, from the model, you can extract the behavior of omega prime. And as was in the case of omega, this is below one. So always there's a natural expectation that anti-lambdas are less than lambdas, either from the corona or from the core. So the way we obtain the intrinsic polarization is to think that if we have the QGP in thermal equilibrium, then we can couple, let's see here, we can couple the quark to the vertical properties of the thermal system through an effective coupling where you have the vorticity coming in here and the quark spin operator talking to the vorticity in direct way. And this is where the modeling comes in, right? So there's as far as I know, there's very few ideas on how to do this at a microscopic level. There's always this mechanical coupling or this coupling through electromagnetic fields, which is also interesting. But this is a way to say that the system will need some time, which has to do with this interaction rate. The inverse of this interaction rate gives me the time it takes for this quark to learn about the vorticity of the system. So we can have the intrinsic polarization from this idea.
Does people have estimates for how big G is microscopically, or is it something that take that as a phenomenological parameter?
Yeah.
You said that it's difficult to get that from microscopic physics. Is that right?
Yes.
Does that mean that G is you can't connect that to fundamental parameters?
This is a very good question, and I'm working right now on that, because if the process under which a strange quark knows about the vorticity of the system is like this, if it is like this, then I have to sort of bootstrap the regions for the size of this coupling, yes. I have an idea on what to use. I can use the regular QCD coupling if I want to. Use arguments to do running of scales and to propose a size of this. I do that in the model, right? But this is an open question. If this is the way to do arc spin alignment, yes.
And this operator differentiates strange from anti-strange? Shouldn't it be able to do that to get the different polarization for the lambda to lambda?
Actually, this is another good question. Up to here, no. There's no.
So where's the differentiation going to come then?
From the mechanisms of production. So.
But if both mechanisms, I mean, the corona is not producing polarization. And if this mechanism is blind to strange versus anti-strange, where's the difference going to come from?
Well, okay. So. There is no difference at this level. There is no difference in the way the system is changing. There is no difference in the vorticity. But if you are analyzing the intrinsic polarization for strangeness or for anti-strangeness, what you find is that there is... Let me go to here. The way you calculate the number of lambdas is through an integral in a region where you have a certain number of participants in the collision, right? The traditional Glauber or geometrical picture is that you have so many protons available in this overlapping region. And depending on the number of the participants in this region, I have a critical number of participants that beyond that critical number, I can or cannot create the QGP. Okay, that's one thing. Now, the number of lambdas that I create from the QGP turns out to be proportional to this number of participants. But the proportionality is not the same for strange or anti-strange. I'm giving you like a summarized version. And the whole thing is connected to the fact that in these situations, you don't have the same available matter and antimatter. You always have a chemical potential different than zero. So what does that give you as a possibility to create more lambdas than anti-lambdas? I can show you exactly what this model gives us. So.
At the end of the day, it's the chemical potential that drives it.
That's part of the thing, yes? Oops, I went back too far.
I would have naively guessed that the chemical potential just affects the overall number of lambdas versus anti-lambdas, but not the polarization. It's just the chemical potential.
It controls the availability of lambdas and anti-lambdas. That's it, right? But as I was telling you before, in our model, if you tell me how many lambdas or anti-lambdas are available in some situation, what you're telling me is basically this part of the these red parts or these blue parts. But you see, the contribution of those lambdas and anti-lambdas to the polarization, to the global polarization, is weighted differently. So in the case for the lambdas, it only matters how the lambdas are intrinsically picking up this polarization. But in the case of the anti-lambdas, it's an interplay between these processes that I'm telling you about.
CNC bar, then you're going to take to be equal.
Sorry?
And C bar in the end are going to be equal. Set and set bar. Numerically equal in the end?
No. I can calculate them. Yeah, I can calculate them using data from the evolution of the system, the time the QGP exists, let's say, and the volume of the QGP.
So you're going to feed it to data.
Yeah.
I see.
So what is tau? How do I interpret?
So tau is the inverse of the decay or reaction of the quark coming through and coupling to the vorticity. So it's kind of a, think of it as a relaxation time. So it means that the strange quark and anti-strange quark have different ways to incorporate or to learn about the medium and its vorticity. And that, in turn, affects the way that I'm calculating polarization. Let me continue before I run out of time. So what happens is that this peak that Mina was asking me about, what is this kind of baroque behavior that we get from our model? Well, it turns out that if I change the impact parameter in the initial condition, if I go from very central collisions to very peripheral collisions, there is a game-changing thing happening in the mechanism through which I'm getting my lambdas. So for certain energies and for certain initial conditions, I get more lambdas from the QGP than lambdas from the corona, but that picture can change at some critical energy, right? And so it's not always what I mean is for energy, it's not for any energy collision, you don't always have more lambdas than anti-lambdas. You can have a situation in which it reverses. And this is why it goes up and down, basically.
Malena.
Yes.
What sets that energy? Is there an intuition where the energy, because it doesn't.
Yeah. This, the collision energy?
The energy where this transition between the two.
This mechanism, yes. Good. You mean the crossing, the up and down?
I mean, because it looks like it's happening at a few GeV, so I would imagine it was happening at lower energies, but.
Yes. So we tried to show this in this very weird plot. I don't know if you can see it back there, but we have a plot in which we show the behavior of lambdas producing the QGP versus the corona, and we show this suppression factor, and we see that the peak is very near. It's a combination of threshold production for lambdas, but also you can play around with this peak, changing the properties of the QGP. So changing the chemical potential and changing. I hope I answered your question, but if you can look at the global polarization with respect to the intrinsic polarization. So if you want to remove any stuff that comes from our modeling of this time relaxation, relaxation time, if you want to, let's say, not discuss that for a moment, you can play this game in which you can ask a question in terms of what happens if the properties of the QGP change, then who wins on top of that, and how this peak moves, let's say. And that's why we present our results using these bands, basically.
Okay, thanks. I have an even dumber question.
That's okay.
This may be something that you said in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Why can't you do the same measurement with protons and antiprotons?
Why can't you? Sorry? Protons and antiprotons, what?
Do the same measurement with protons and antiprotons. Because there the chemical potential should be higher for those, right? There's much more up and down quark inside the quark gluon plasma. So the chemical potential should be much more different for protons than for antiprotons, that is for lambdas and lambda bars.
No, but hold on. So for proton collisions or antiproton collisions, the system as a collective thing, it's not clear that we can produce it. I mean, there's arguments that we can, and we can discuss that, but there's no QGP or there's no core corona thing.
I think she means just like in the final state having a proton or antiproton.
Yeah.
But how do you measure proton
polarization? In the final state, where? Sorry?
So here you have your nuclei that are producing lambdas.
Uh-huh.
In the lambdas, you have the polarization asymmetry.
Yes.
She's saying, forget about lambdas, produce instead protons and antiprotons. They should also have a polarization. And since the chemical potential to produce protons is lower.
Okay. Okay. So without discussing the lambdas, you mean? Without putting in
it's very.
No. It's a good question. I can think of a for us, that will be equivalent to a background. I don't know if I'm understanding the question properly.
I want
polarization?
Yeah, then carry on. Then
she means like the residual. If
you're measuring polarization because you could track the
lambda. Yeah, I can track the lambda through the daughters.
So how would you, I think she's asking, could you do, is there an observable you could use where you don't need the lambda, you could measure the polarization of protons somehow? And is there an asymmetry?
Okay. I didn't understand it like that, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. This is what I'm asking. Like in the final state, you have protons and antiprotons because the chemical potential for protons will be much more different than it is for antiprotons, given that the up and down component inside your collision is much higher than it is for the stress.
But how would you measure?
You can measure the polarization.
How would you measure? How would you do that? Maybe you can. I don't know.
I'm asking.
Okay. I can think about that. I don't know how though.
Think on an event by event basis, you cannot measure the proton polarization.
I think you can if you go to smaller species and you have a control on the polarization in the initial condition, like you would in regular PP collisions. I would have a polarized beam of protons. I don't know if that's what you mean. I would have an initial condition.
Final thing. Malena, carry, because this is very big, and I...
Okay, that's...
I'm back.
It's interesting. I'm
taking away your time, and you don't have much left.
That's fine. Okay, so let me wrap it up. So the point is that we have these bands, which are the width of these bands and the peak and the coming down of the bands are controlled by these different mechanisms. The other thing is that back then we didn't have data lower than 7 GeV, so we didn't know what the data was going to say about after we produced this model. So now what we have is this data here that is around 3 and 4 GeVs from Hades, some preliminary data. Error bars are a problem there. And many things are an issue, open issue right now. But people in general are excited because at least we can see a global systematic of something huge happening here and then something more less worrisome than these error bars here going down in the central value. And what we did was to send Cornas for Hades collaboration. We did a run of our model of prediction of these bands in the context of this experiment, which has very different situations than the RIC experiment does. In particular, they were doing gold collisions are 2.4 GeV, and they were doing silver collisions. And it was very weird. We had to adapt our nuclear models to silver. Silver is very small compared to these other things that we were doing. Anyways, we sent this plot to them because it was the only thing that was telling us that indeed the model that we have sort of does something interesting to explain the fact that Hades is measuring a non-zero polarization or something that is colliding at 2.4 GeV. I don't know if you can sense the interesting things here, but threshold production for lambdas is at 4 in PP collisions. So it's very weird. So we have lambdas coming from these very slow collisions for smallish systems, error bars pending to be improved. But our model seems to be telling us something non-trivial about the fact that lambdas and anti-lambdas are polarized differently and that this polarization is not running out of fuel only due to vorticity, only. Vorticity is a big driver, it is, but there's something else that we need to figure out in terms of how does the spin of the constituent quark of these particles is knowing about the system in which this particle is being born, let's say. Another interesting thing that I can say before running out of time is that given that vorticity doesn't distinguish in terms of particles and antiparticles, if I want to transfer or modify the spin, then it should be helpful to be measuring more massive hyperons in this game and to be learning about the massive cousins of lambdas and anti-lambdas To be learning about the polarization for them implies that we can sort of figure out if the contributions to polarization should be richer, not only due to this, let's say, mechanical coupling or quantum mechanical coupling, if you want, but also due to other processes where these more heavy hyperons come in. Data is a bit sketchy for now, but we do have this available data for them. And so the work for us is to try to implement what we did for lambdas and anti-lambdas now to these other guys here, to try to see if it works in any case, right? It should. So I guess I'm going to stop here because I ran out of time. And so if there's more questions or discussions, we can do that.
I said this before, but I know that, and I don't know the heavy ion.
That's okay.
Very well. How many different experiments see this?
So it's hard to see here, but if you go, these are TEVs already in collision. And so you have these little blocks of data down here, which correspond to ALICE. ALICE is at the LHC. So that's consistent with zero. Actually, the size of the error bars is, you cannot see it here, but it's consistent with zero. That's very high collision system. Now you start going down here to 200 GeV. That's RIC. And so STAR started giving us data for 200 and then going as low as 7 GeV. And recently, this year, as low as 3 GeV. So they're going here. So these two sets of data are as best as we can have them for now. And these two sets, which are in the lower collision regime, are pending. They're still being analyzed, right? At GSI. And so, of course, the usual discussion is how significant this signal is, because it's only like 2 sigma. When you clean up the error bars, you can see, well, it's only 2 sigma. I mean, should we really worry? I guess that the thing is, well, we should be really worrying, even not if you want to ignore this part. The problem starts down here because the systematics tells us that the polarization is non-zero, first of all. So that's very new compared to high energy collisions. And so that's first and foremost. And in the initial models, the simulations explain this region fairly well. But the work now is to see, well, there was a huge excitement because vorticity gives you, opens the door for you for many hydrodynamical features, right? You have charge moving in flows. So you have Hall effect. You have all these wonderful like electromagnetic effects that you can include in your description. And the idea is, well, yeah, but how relevant are they, right? We also are working on an idea of if you have charge moving, then you have magnetic fields. These magnetic fields are very intense. So the magnetic field on its own should polarize your situation, right? But then it polarizes everybody, and so you start to play this game of in the meantime, while this data gets a bit better, if this situation remains, it'd be so interesting because it means that we're near an energy that is so low that we're describing a QGP that is very asymmetric in matter and antimatter. And so in the phase space of nuclear matter, if I do this traditional phase diagram of nuclear matter, where I have temperature in this region and I have this chemical potential, imagine the QGP is studied at the LHC. Usually, it's very near, a symmetrical situation in amount of matter and antimatter. So you're scanning through this region of phase space. But what we're looking at here is a system that is being created at a finite chemical potential. And the question is, if I scan here using BESS at BNL, using, let's say, the BESS Hades star, I'm basically analyzing a system where the asymmetry in the initial condition and in the situation for the QGP is being probed. You are down here, so you create a QGP that is very different in properties than the one that you create out here. And so maybe polarization peaking is an indication that you're getting near a region of interest for this phase diagram. This is not the only issue that you take into account, but this is one of many, right? Yes, yes. Somebody wanted to ask a question, or?
Anyone else from Zoom?
Maybe you could just tell us what the early photon problem is. That sounds.
Ah, the early photon, yes. Well, it was kind of like a menu. I didn't know what you felt like today after Halloween and stuff. It's another weird thing that we don't know what's going on there. Let me just briefly tell you the data, right, which is the exciting thing for me. So this is the bunch of photons that you can collect from a heavy ion collision in terms of the amount of transverse momenta and the region in rapidity that you collected from. And in the horizontal axis is the energy, or PT, of these photons. So this is the PT spectra of photons. And open symbols are PP data, PP collisions. And open black, open red, and open inverse triangle. And these guys here, the blue ones, are gold-gold collisions, heavy ion collisions. So you see, I don't know if you can see, but from 4-point-something down, gold-gold data gives us more photons that we can explain, let's say. These curves are the curve that tells me how can I go from the number of photons in a PP collision to the number of photons in a gold-gold collision if I just multiply by the number of binary collisions that I can create in this gold-gold collision. So this is basically an excess in the photons that I can explain. It's also, if I show you, I don't know if there's a thermal fit here. No, there's no thermal fit. Anyways, there's several plots that I can add here, and none of the models can explain this huge amount of photons, very low energy photons. So they are very old or early in the collision. They are coming really from the early stages of the collision. That's not the only thing. The other thing is that they don't come out isotropically. This V2, think about it as the Fourier coefficient of the angular distribution of these photons, the second coefficient. And so it turns out that the photons have a fairly large V2, which is they come out, instead of coming out like in a kind of a spherical angular distribution, they come out in a more like a oblong distribution. And also, the pions do that.
Relative to
some axis that you can create, or some plane that you can create in terms of the beam and the impact parameter. So that's a production plane, how do you call it? Reaction plane, yeah. So, So the weird thing is that the thermal, the The PT distribution of these early photons tells us that they are very old. So they are coming from the QGP, let's say. But they are not pushed evenly. So they are not really thermal photons in that sense, because those I can describe very well. So there are some extra photons that I need to know where they are, why they are created.
Small PT mean it's very old?
Okay. Let me see if I have. If so, usually, if I have photons coming from decays, they tend to have a PT spectra that looks like the PT spectra. Well, it derives from the PT spectra of the parent hadron that produced it, let's say. So there's like a bound of PT from the parent. If it was a hard scattering, I sort of know how the PT of these photons should behave like. In fact, I can calculate it because I know how to do these Feynman diagrams where I have prompt photons, or, you know, I can do that calculation. I can have the PT spectra. And of course, they come in all PT ranges. It's not like exclusively they come in, you know, high PT. But when I do that calculation and I do some other ones, not me myself, but the community, if you calculate these diagrams, but you also take into account photons coming from decays, and you also take into account some other channels, all the channels that you can think of producing photons, and you put this line on top of this data, you realize that the ones you cannot explain are the ones below for GB in this PT spectrum. And given that theoretically you've thought of all the possible channels, and we know better the later stages, right? Because it's hadrons decaying, you know that from ages. We assume that the ones that we cannot explain should be primordial. They should be very early in the collision being produced. And so people propose some topological ideas, some violation of anomalies, some very nice, like, Baroque explanations for these photons. And so the problem that I can discuss in maybe some other seminar is, well, if you have very intense magnetic fields in the collision, because you have this bunch of protons creating these humongous, very short pulse magnetic fields, then the magnetic field should catalyze, should open channels for production of photons. And that's what we did. We just calculated, like you would for axions and some other guys there, the magnetic field as a mediator that helps you. So that's the problem. Let me just show you what we got, because at least I can tell you. So if we take the data and subtract all the photons that I can explain with, let's say, regular ideas of photon production, and I plot our result that comes from this magnetic process, but you need to do that, and you need to fix the V2 as well. You cannot do only that, because these photons are anisotropic. So for low energy of photons, we can sort of explain this V2. But it, due to the approximations of our calculation, it gets ruined for larger energies. So anyways, it's an open discussion. The name of this puzzle is called the direct photon puzzle in heavy ion collisions. And it's very exciting in the sense that anyone could have an idea pretty much now.
So do most people think it comes from the magnetic fields? Because
no,
don't have any reason to be isotropic, right? Like, the magnetic fields can be very complicated, right?
Yes. Usually, with respect to the reaction plane, in this very geometrical picture of heavy ion collisions, usually the dominant contribution of the magnetic field is perpendicular to this reaction plane, either up or down. Yeah. Usually. And usually when you take averages over many events, what you see is that one of these is bigger than the other, so you have a net magnetic field. The size of the pulse is crucial because you cannot do, let's say, magnetized plasma calculations and explain this away this way, because the magnetic field is not there forever. So it's not injecting any energy to the system. It's not. It's a very peculiar behavior of this magnetic field. So learning about how does a magnetic field get created in heavy ion collisions, it's a field on its own right now. People started doing regular classical electrodynamics, but now there's a large amount of work done. And measuring this magnetic field, it's one of the tasks for this program right now, if it is indeed created, right?
That was very complicated.
Well, it's not as complicated as the stuff that I've been learning here about celestial amplitudes and all these things, which is just let me just tell you, in case you want to discuss something in the hallway or anywhere, actually. I am interested right now in taking lessons or learning about how people in the past have bootstrapped many things in heavy ion collisions. So the bootstrapping program in heavy ion collisions is very old because we didn't have many tools. So I'm revisiting bootstrapping, especially for polarization and critical studies. So if I have data from polarization or from criticality, fluctuations especially, how can I bootstrap these effective models that we use to describe spin, for example? This is one of the main questions that I'm studying here or learning about here. And in a few days, in the middle of November, we will have visitors working with Freddy. You're welcome to come to our discussions, because recently, there's been a connection made in a classical limit between thermal amplitudes and gravity amplitudes. So usually when people find these kind of things, it means that for us that we do calculations like this, it should mean that we should save some time doing some calculations if we have these kind of connections. And so in a few days, we're going to be discussing that with Leonardo and Freddy. And if you're interested, you're welcome to come in to do that. So that's. Thank you.